Keeping the COVID inquiry honest, it's time for the inquiry sessions.
My name is Alastair Harding, and today on the inquiry sessions here on Reality Check Radio, we're joined by Dr. Emmanuel Garcia, who has not only been a regular face and a staunch voice of opposition to the vaccine mandates that scarred our country during the COVID era, but he's also become well known for his Substack writings that can be found on the NZDSOS website. And today we're talking with Dr. Garcia about the COVID inquiry in the people's terms that can be found at www.covidinquiry.co.nz, where you can find all the support you need to tell the COVID Royal Commission your story. Manny, thanks for joining us today. It's so good to catch up again. What's your submission to the inquiry going to say?
Well, what I would be wanting to inform the commission about would be the absence of any initiative for early treatment during the COVID crisis, so-called, and also the actual suppression of early treatment when we knew that such treatment was available, followed by the persecution, the active persecution of doctors as we speak by the medical council for having acted as good doctors, namely by having tried to treat people who were symptomatic and also by having provided informed consent, which is the other major issue that I would be most interested to alert the commission to.
Were you surprised that the government had such a single-minded focus on vaccines as the solution to all of this at the detriment of all the other treatment options that were available?
Well, I was kind of incredulous. I couldn't believe it. And I think that was probably the single most important aspect of all of this that alerted me to some ulterior agenda. In the case of a so-called pandemic or medical crisis or health problem, you would think there would be a stampede, kind of a race for treatment, for cure, a marvelous competition. Instead, there was actually absolutely nothing. It was all, if you get symptoms of COVID, sit at home. If you find that after a while you can't breathe, then get to the hospital. I mean, it's hard to understand an honest government promulgating such an approach to what they've deemed to be a medical crisis, and it's irresponsible as well.
What were the other treatments that you consider were looked past?
Well, early treatment protocols started to appear quite early in 2020. Vladimir Zelenko, the now deceased doctor from the States, had promoted hydroxychloroquine with zinc, vitamin D, and vitamin C. And we know that in India, there was the use of ivermectin in Uttar Pradesh, that big segment of India, that Japan actually also introduced, I believe it was ivermectin, but they were various protocols that were designed to help people with symptoms, to prevent bacterial pneumonia, to prevent late stage or end stage kind of respiratory problems. And the government here was absolutely silent about all of this. And their stance became, there's nothing that can be done. Stay at home, stay locked up, don't go anywhere, stay 6 feet or 12 feet from people around you, put your masks on, destroy your businesses, and we're going to wait for the magic vaccine, the vaccine that could not have been adequately tested because it could not have withstood the test of time. And in addition, the Pfizer jab had all kinds of problems with the trial period and their actual testing period. So in my view, the jab itself was never necessary, and at the time, I even thought it was absolutely dangerous and it would cause an autoimmune nightmare. And I've since been proved correct in these counts.
In normal times, if there is an unknown disease that comes along, what do doctors usually do? My understanding is that they usually go to their tried and tested treatments. And in this case, that was the likes of ivermectin, which had been around for many, many years. And I believe the inventor had even won the Nobel Prize for it. Why throw that out right from the very beginning?
Well, I can't analyze the actions of a government that wouldn't promote treatment and rational approaches to an illness or a health problem. I can't understand why they would do that unless there were some other agenda. Now, people have speculated that as part of the agreement with Pfizer, that there would have been a clause stipulating that there be no other treatments available while the country was allowed to use their injection. We do not have a copy of the Pfizer agreement, unfortunately, and I think that would be very helpful for us to see. We have some other agreements that have been published between Pfizer and other governments around the world, and it looks as if something along those lines had been included. But again, we're talking about an upending of everything rational here in medicine. First of all, you don't quarantine healthy people. This was never in any pandemic protocol in the history of modern medicine. Secondly, you don't promulgate fear and create a panic among people. You don't use tests that are highly dubious to emphasize that kind of panic. You should act rationally, calmly, and follow basic common medical sense, which includes informed consent, the search, and the use of early of treatment that is not harmful, and the adequate testing if a vaccine is developed of that vaccine. And that adequate testing really takes years. It doesn't take months. It doesn't happen overnight. So we had lots of principles that were overthrown.
What are the conversations that were had between doctors? Why don't more doctors speak up about this?
Well, I think there are two reasons why doctors don't speak up about this. I think to begin with, the medical council indulged in mafia tactics by making examples of those doctors like myself who did speak up about basic medical principles. We had our licenses suspended. That sent a clear message to the other 19 or 20,000 doctors practicing in New Zealand that if you dare to raise your voice against what we're telling you to do, we're going to go after you. That's number one. Number two, I think that the atmosphere of fear was so strong and was pushed so hard with case counts, death counts, whatever. And New Zealand actually was really very, very safe, very, very isolated, and in a great position to lead the world without fear, that some doctors decided to abandon their wits and abandon their medical principles and just do what they were told. Third, I should mention that I am sure there were financial incentives to jab as many people as possible.
Have you had any informal conversations with doctors who perhaps didn't speak out and who perhaps maybe wish they did?
I've had some conversations. I think that the conversations have always sort of centered upon the notion of, well, what could I do? I had to keep my mortgage. I had to keep my family together. I wasn't in a position to say anything. I tried to mitigate damage and whatnot. But also there were a number of doctors, primarily I know them through New Zealand doctors speaking out with science, who didn't follow the party line. And unfortunately, many of them now are being persecuted and harassed by a thoroughly corrupt medical council that is in league with the Federation of State Medical Boards.
And for those people, the COVID era is not over because they just can't go back and work.
Well, for those people, the COVID era is not over because they're worried about their licenses. They're worried about what's happening with these professional conduct complaints. They're worried about being hauled before the health practitioners disciplinary tribunal, like my friend Peter Canada, as he was treated. I spoke to Peter on several occasions. He had a beautiful brief wherein he answered all of the allegations against him, but it made no difference to what I deemed to be quite a kangaroo court.
And we've spoken to Peter on this show on the inquiry sessions previously about that. Can you tell me, what's the importance of informed consent? That's another one of the topics that you're wanting to talk about today. What's the importance of that?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, instead of my talking about it, I'm going to talk to you about a letter that was sent by the medical council to all of the medical practitioners and doctors in New Zealand about informed consent, in 5 December 2019. All right? There was an updated statement on informed consent signed by CEO Joan Simeone, who now is coincidentally enough the chair of the international arm of the Federation of State Medical Boards. And it stated the following. The key points about informed consent are, every time a treatment is provided, a doctor must have permission to provide that treatment. The process of obtaining that permission is called informed consent. Without informed consent, the treatment may be unlawful. To help the patient decide whether they want a treatment, they first need to be given information such as the risks and benefits of their treatment options. I'll go on and quote a little more from that also. Obtaining consent, this is still a quote, is a process of shared decision-making where a doctor helps the patient understand their medical condition and the options for treating or not treating that condition. It is more than signing forms and completing paperwork. As a doctor, you need to take the time to ask questions so that you understand what matters to your patient and what their concerns, wishes, goals, and values are. All right, so that's December 2019, okay?
Okay.
Then on 28 April 21, I believe, they issued a statement in the medical council in conjunction with the dental council on professional responsibility and the COVID-19 vaccine, so-called. And basically, they said that not only are health practitioners themselves expected to get the jab, but they write that it is our view that there is no place for anti-vaccination messages in professional health practice, nor any promotion of anti-vaccination claims, including on social media and advertising by health practitioners, while simultaneously advising that as a health practitioner, you have a role in providing evidence-based advice and information about the COVID-19 vaccination to others. You should be prepared to discuss evidence-based information about vaccination and its benefits to assist informed decision-making. So that you have a really mealy-mouthed, creepy kind of statement that tells you you can't say anything basically against the Pfizer jab, but you're supposed to somehow provide some kind of informed decision-making comments to a patient. And I know that when people did try to provide informed consent to patients, and remember that in medicine, there is never any one size fits all, and that this vaccine, so-called, was a new and experimental agent untested by time, that these people were called before the medical council, and had their licenses suspended and harassed and persecuted. So on the one hand, you have a very strong statement about what we need to do to provide informed consent, and then all of a sudden the jab comes along and true informed consent gets thrown out the window, and those who try to provide informed consent are persecuted.
I would say it would be impossible to give informed consent if you can't talk about all the different types of the or all the different aspects of the vaccine. Yet, you know, those quotes that you just gave, I'm looking at a Radio New Zealand story here from around the time when you and Peter Canaday and Matt Shelton were all suspended. And one of the quotes here, it says, "Council expects doctors to be aware of and comply with its published standards of clinical and ethical practice." It was stated by New Zealand Medical Council Chair Dr. Curtis Walker. The words ethical practice in that stand out to me. What could be more ethical than to tell patients about all the potential side effects?
Well, exactly. It's your duty. I mean, it's our duty to tell them about any side effects that we know about, or to warn people who have certain, for example, certain autoimmune conditions or who might be pregnant, that getting an untested gene-altering experimental agent may not be in their interests. They may choose to go ahead and get it, but even so, there was a lack of information because we did not have the data about any long-term consequences.
Well, it was impossible to at that time, wasn't it?
It was impossible because it wasn't out there long enough. The study, the material could not have been gathered. The evidence could not have been accrued. So, it's a travesty. It's a travesty of medicine, and it's a travesty to persecute doctors who kept faithful to principles of established medicine in their practices.
So, what would you want people to talk about if they're putting in a submission with the COVID inquiry this weekend before the deadline on Sunday? What would you like people to be highlighting to the commission at this point?
I would like them to be highlighting the glaring and shameful absence of the discussion of early treatment and prevention. And I would also like them to be highlighting the hypocritical attitude towards informed consent when it came to the Pfizer inoculation.
One of the other parts of this is, you know, when we talk about informed consent, I know it's a slightly different topic, but it always brings to mind the way that Chris Hipkins at the end of last year told us that nobody was ever forced to take it, that these mandates that they put across everybody was not forcing them to do it, even though it was in the pain of losing your job or losing your business.
Yeah, well, that's just absolutely disgraceful. Yes, I can't force you to take it, but if you don't take it, and if you're a nurse and you're raising three kids on your own and you have no other source of income, then you just have no job. And if you have no job, then what happens? Okay, and I know many people who took this under duress when they didn't want to take it. I know people who have had some severe adverse reactions to it. In fact, I know a psychiatric nurse, a young one, who developed severe myocarditis because she had to take the jab to keep her job. Otherwise, she'd be living in poverty. So this idea that no one is forced. Well, another trick that they've pulled is to say, okay, you know what? There are no mandates anymore, but the employer, the Fatuora or the DHBs, will insist upon you having been jabbed to get a job. So what happened to the end of mandates? In effect, mandates are still occurring in certain segments of the employment sector. It's shameful.
To sum up, to finish our interview today, is that the legacy that you'll take away from this period in history, that it was shameful?
Well, I think it was more than shameful. It was absolutely criminal.
Well, on that note, thank you, Manny, for joining us today. I know this period hasn't been easy for you, but you have actually been a real source of strength and inspiration to many of us who question the official narrative, especially since you come from the medical profession. So we truly appreciate that.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Alistair. Best wishes, and let's hope that the inquiry achieves something positive and prevents any further shameful and criminal acts in future.
And for all of you who haven't submitted to the COVID inquiry yet, please visit www.covidinquiry.co.nz. That's inquiry with an I. And see how you can submit your story and register your support for the people's terms. Again, that's www.covidinquiry.co.nz. My name's Alistair Harding, and you've been listening to the Inquiry Sessions only on Reality Check Radio.
The RCR Inquiry Sessions. Unpacking the COVID response for an honest inquiry.